was it 2014 we talked last? I can't remember.
I think so, 14 or 15, because it's been a couple of years at least. That's why I was kind of going, geez, I haven't talked to Stan Deo for a couple of years. I've got to find out what he thinks about this whole election, what's happened, you know, the whole bit. So did you see this one coming?
No, it was a complete surprise. I mean, we did vote in the election. We did vote for Mr. Trump, and, you know, it was we were pleased to see the groundswell and hopefully people, you know, getting wise to what should be done. But I'm afraid that what's happened, even though we support Mr. Trump, what's happened is that no matter which way the election went, we're going to see such division in the country that we're going to experience a revolution one way or another.
And you know what? I totally agree with you. And this is the part about the whole thing that is scaring everybody I talk to. I'm going to tell you a little story, Stan. I was off shooting my TV show this last week. And one of the women that I'm on the show with, her and I were sitting down to breakfast. Thank God it was the last day of our shoot, because we started this whole conversation about how she said she was freaking out about the ban on travel for the Muslim countries. And I said to her, I said, well, what's wrong with that? I said, I have no problem with it. I said, isn't it about time we started taking care of our own? And I explained to her about how I drive through Marin County, one of the richest counties in the United States, and there are homeless people on the streets at every corner begging for money, and they don't have a place to live. And I'm thinking to myself, why are we sending money everywhere else and letting people into this country when we have nobody here taking care of our own, right? And she was just incensed that these people were being locked out of our country. And I said, but aren't you hearing me? We have people here that need our help. And it's like there's this weird glassy-eyed expression that comes over them that they don't seem to care about anybody here in the United States. All they care about is how we look to the rest of the world. And I just don't get this, Stan. It's scaring me.
Holly and I say the same thing almost twice a day. It's just, it's madness that these people do not see we need this to preserve the country that people want to get into. You know,
absolutely.
It's a lifeboat. It's a you know, great lifeboat, but if they all come in without the captain's permission, it'll sink the lifeboat.
Absolutely. It's time we just stop what I call stop the madness. We have to take care of our own, and especially our vets. Nothing bothers me more than, well, actually the vets and the elderly women. When I see elderly women on the streets, that really, I mean, the guys, it's bad enough, right? But guys have different physical needs. And if they, you know, they can handle, you know, whatever they do, their business and what have you, pretty much out in the, you know, the woods somewhere, right? But for women, it's much more difficult. And the older you get as a woman, there's a lot of strange things that happen to your body. And I just don't understand how people can allow elderly women to be homeless and on the street. I just don't even get that. It kind of blows my mind. I mean, I sit here and I'm in pure, and it's more bewilderment than it is amazement, because I don't understand how this has even happened to our country. And that these people just sit around all day long professing that we've got to be kind to others in the world. And I'm like, well, they wouldn't let you into their country. So what the hell do you think it's doing, you know, letting them into ours? Anyhow, I just go nuts over it.
You know, we need to take away the rose-tinted glasses. They're not seeing clearly.
They're not. What happened? Did they all get brainwashed somewhere? You know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, I put on the mind control summits. So I'm the lady out there that's been screaming for 5 or 6 years that they're mind controlling us. There's targeted individuals. There's all these, you know, COINTELPRO things going on. There's all these false flags. And we've got all this going on, right? And then on top of it all, we just have the basic mind control of going to school every day and then coming out of it thinking that all that matters is money and who cares about the next guy, right? They're breeding empathy out of society is what I see it. What do you think?
Well, yes and no. They're breeding empathy for our own people, our own society out of us. The empathy
exactly.
For all these others. And it's a, you know, it's not a balanced economy when they think that way. To help the others, you've got to get home fixed first. We have to stop just throwing money out the door, which President Trump is certainly doing his best to stop. But I think that, like Hollywood, is a major influence in TV and movies. And, of course, Hollywood is all this, oh, life is wonderful, you throw the rose petals, it's just crazy. And this has gone all through our young people, the millennial generation. They haven't had a chance to realize that there's more to it than this. They see it in the movies and their social media, they're playing games, and they're totally distracted by all these things that are just taking their attention off the news.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, people, it's interesting. You guys, do you guys grow your own food? Do you have your own kind of, like, compound where you're at, or are you guys just taking care of yourself?
No, we put food away, and we've got a, you know, a wooden fence around the property, and we have an orchard, and we have raised gardens. Holly's written books about that, garden.
Yeah. And, I love her. I just wanted her to know that I adore her books. You know, I grew up on a farm, and see, that's another problem. Once you've grown up in an area where you're self-sustaining, my family always had enough food for ourselves and our neighbors, and my neighbors also had enough food for themselves and their neighbors, and we always grew our own food. So I didn't even understand this whole concept of people not growing their own food and surviving off the land. It was just kind of, you know, I was born into it, so I get it, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It just blows my mind when I see people that don't even know where their groceries come from.
I know. God. They think some machine in the back room prints it and packages it and put it out there for them. But they,
well, yeah. What might be happening, Stan, is that might be a reality pretty soon. Have you seen the new 3D printers of meat? Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have, actually. We're talking about doing that for some of the Mars programs and things as well, in addition to printing the bunkers or how, or, you know, like the habitats are going to live in there, sending up 3D printers that will print buildings. I'm still wrapping my mind around that one, but anyway.
I know. That's a crazy one. Well, let's get back to the revolution in the country, and then, you know, for the rest of the show, we will hit on everything you have on your website, so just be prepared for that, because I kind of want to break it apart and tell everybody all about you in a piece-by-piece fashion during the rest of the show. But I just thought at the beginning of the show we'd talk politics and see where you and Holly were at with that. And so anyhow, back to the revolution thing. What is your take on how this revolution is going to happen, and if we're going to have one at all? I mean, because I'm kind of concerned. I think we need one, but I don't know if it's going to happen or not. What's your take?
Well, Holly just wrote another book about prophetic perils, end time events revealed. That was last year she published that, and I did a lecture on that as well, talking about the book up in the Springs. It is hundreds of pages talking about prophecy, talking about ISIS and famines and Iklis cities and all kinds of stuff that we need to know right now. And it tells you in the book, she tells you about the threat for civil war. She tells you about the threat of American destruction by invasion by China and Russia and possibly Iran, stuff like that. Now, this is the real clear and present danger. We have a nation that is divided in it. It didn't matter who won the election, we were going to have this problem. It was driven by people like George Soros, who comes into a country, wants to overthrow, puts out new information, finances groups that are extremists to cause the disruption, the chaos, you know, the division in the country. Now, while we're fighting with each other, and you know, the left wing is not as well armed and prepared to endure that kind of stuff, but I'm sure that there will be some fanatical groups that will be funded, and we'll probably trigger either, you know, the necessity for martial law or just out-and-out shooting battles between little groups of people all across the country. We can't afford that, but that's probably what's going to happen. It'll be well planned so that we're a house divided, we're a house in chaos. Here we are in a new administration, and, you know, it takes at least 100 days normally to get your act together, get everybody familiar with their job and corresponding with each other properly and that kind of, you know, communicating. And here we are, you know, like month one, and, you know, we've still got another 60 to 70 days to go on normal time schedules without all the opposition we're getting from the left wing. So our house is still unprotected. It's still divided. And now would be a perfect time for foreign powers, particularly Russia, to launch EMP attacks and then nuclear attacks that will destroy a place like New York. And there are 120 other target cities as well they have on their map. But this is what we've got to get ready for, to, if we have any hope of rebuilding what's left after the war starts and finishes, it'll be a quick one, then we need to have people, like you're talking about, with provisions for themselves and their neighbors and defense and communications that that they store away in Faraday cages so that they can communicate and form groups together after everything's knocked out. And
well,
that's
an interesting whole concept, this whole EMP attack. People have no idea how it's going to throw them back to the Stone Age. I mean, they just don't even get the concept. Can you imagine? Have you seen those TV commercials where the family is not online on their phone for like 5 minutes and they go crazy?
I laugh, but it's correct. That's what's going to happen.
Exactly. I see a whole nation of people going nuts in 24 hours and walking around just kind of drooling because they're not tethered to their cell phone anymore.
Well, and they sit across the table from each other now and text each other, and they can't do that. They sit there and stare at each other. What do I do now?
They might have to actually open their mouth and communicate. Wouldn't that be something? And look each other in the eye for a change. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
You know, that's another problem. I don't know how you and Holly are dealing with it, but I've got a very sneaking suspicion that a lot of this whole agenda from the left wing in a very clandestine way, but maybe it's becoming more and more obvious, is this whole transhumanism agenda. And how are you and Holly on that? Do you have any opinion about it? Do you think it's happening? Do you think that they're really trying to change us into just autonomous, automatons, basically like the Borg, where we just all obey and do what they tell us to do? And, you know, I'm telling you, Stan, I've never seen so many people with these big corporations. For example, I call in and I go, I'm closing out a bill for Pacific Gas and Electric, for example. And they say, well, we can't make payment arrangements. And I said, well, I'm turning off my service and, you know, I can't pay the whole bill right now. Can I pay it in 2 or 3 months? And they go, oh, no, we're not allowed to do that. I said, really? Who do I talk to about that? Oh, there isn't anyone. You just have to do what we tell you to do. I'm like, oh, this is very interesting. So there's nobody really above them that can make any decisions anymore. You can't talk with people and work something out.
You know what frosts me even more than that is, like you're saying, you call them to do something like that in your account, and you get someone on the other end of the line and says, "Hello, my name is Bob." You know?
Exactly. And you know they're in the Philippines or India somewhere.
Yeah, of course. I don't know.
Well, what bothers me about that more than I don't care where they're at, but they don't understand the lifestyle here in America, so they really can't make any decisions anyhow. And then if they're going to kick you up to somebody, it's somebody else who lives in that country, and they have no idea what your lifestyle is about. So, you know, how are they going to help? I mean, it's very odd to me. And, you know, I'm hoping against hope that our president now can do something about this. I really want him to complete his promise about bringing jobs back to America. What do you think about his stance on that? Do you think it's going to work?
Well, I'll tell you what, I don't know any other person in the news that we know of that could do it any better if anyone could. I think, I'm hoping the good Lord has blessed this man with the knowledge and the wisdom to do it. He certainly says all the right things, and he's trying to do all the right things. So let's pray the good Lord gives us a respite for 2, 3, 4, 8 years even. But be prepared in case, because that's if everything is, if we're allowed here in America to sort ourselves out. The first 100 days of his office, are maybe 120, are going to be a very volatile, dangerous time for this country's survival. If we can get through that without being attacked, without a massive civil war and a requirement for military law of some sort, martial law, if we can get through that period, then we have a chance. But if not, then pack your bags. I think we're out of here soon.
Well, do you think everybody should stay here and fight? Because I've been seriously thinking about heading to another country, if they'll take me.
I've been to other countries. I've lived in Australia, and I've been over into Europe, and been into the Middle East. And I'll tell you right now, they hate Americans so much over there that you'd be fair game. Anybody leaving the country now, if you could get your money out, which probably could, you're going to put it into foreign banks, and you're going to have people that hate you, and they're going to look at you as the one that caused the problems of the earth. They just view Americans, even in Australia, I mean, that's, friendly country, right? Not so.
Right.
Not so.
Really?
Oh, no, no,
that's
no.
That's the one place I would go. I was thinking about it. I thought, well, you know, why not have a kangaroo farm in the outback?
Have no idea what it's like in a socialist country. That is a socialist country, and it's gotten worse since we left. No.
No.
Well, you're better off sticking here with people that you know. You know, at least you know the mindset. And you can judge people's demeanor, their manner, whether they're lying to you, whether they're, you know, potentially a danger to you. Here, all right, you don't want to be in the major population densities. You want to try to get away from that. But leaving the country is really not a wise option.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Now, we're going to have a break any second now. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I didn't get a chance to tell you this. You got to, if you can, mute during the commercial breaks because everybody can hear you during the break, supposedly. That's what I hear. And so you get to do that. Those are the instructions I was supposed to give you before the show started today. But, of course, we didn't get to that part, did we, Stan?
Oh, I know how to work my mute button.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You know, there's so many guests I have that say they do, and they really don't. I don't know what happens. But anyhow, so we'll have a break any second, and then we'll have one at the top of the hour. You know, the drill. So
yep.
Anyhow, before we get into it, though, I want to tell everybody, go to standeo.com. That's STANDEYO.com and daretoprepare.com, two of my favorite websites. I go there frequently to see what's going on. And we're going to talk the rest of the show about all the different buttons on Stan's website. We've got Holly's Prep. We got the NBC Prep. We got Threat Watch Shop, Donate, Stan's Corner, Holly's Articles, Interviews, Geophysics, Astrophysics, Special Reports, Dream Visions, Faith, and Copyright, because Stan needs a copyright on all this stuff. I'm telling you, there's so much information here, it's mind-boggling. And on the very front page of standeo.com, we have a survey by the National Geographic found that 41% of Americans believe that stocking up on supplies or building a bomb shelter is a wise investment, wiser than a 401k. So I want you guys to get on that website. You know, I pop into the website and I kind of read what Holly's up to, and I do the gardening thing, and then I kind of zip out. And you're doing a lot of YouTube these days. Tell us about, first of all, tell me about this book you've written where you discovered the actual Garden of Eden, and what's going on here?
Well, first of all, it's a DVD. In 2014, that's when I discovered it, and it was not an instant thing. It took several months of research. I am writing a book now, which will cover that in detail, and also the discovery of Atlantis in 2016. All this will be in much more detail in the books, in the book about these two places. But in 2014, I was asked to do a lecture up in Colorado Springs for a Prophecy Watchers group. And there were a few thousand people there, and I showed them the proofs of how I found the four rivers of Eden, and what clues were in the Bible, and what clues we found with Google Earth, and with physics, you know, that I did to show what caused the flood and that kind of stuff. Now, I suppose the Garden of Eden would probably be the first thing. The reason that people hadn't found it yet was a matter of scale. They were looking for a little place, you know, where you put up a wooden fence or something like that. It's a small place. They didn't think big. And not to really discredit these people, I'm just saying that they didn't do it the right way. They chose the wrong path. And the reason is this. The Earth is 25%, was 25% smaller when the Garden of Eden was functioning here on the planet. All the continents that we have separated by ocean now were all crunched together into one landmass with rivers, big rivers in them.
Right.
Okay. Now, and here's something else that people are not aware of. The Earth surface, not the whole Earth inside, but the surface of the Earth has reversed upside down twice, four times, according to the Egyptian records.
Stan, I got to interrupt you because my mind just went, wait, I can't wrap my head around this. When you say reversed, you mean like Africa was pointing down or up or in
up,
a different?
Yep.
Okay.
Our North Pole was at the bottom.
Okay. But that shouldn't make really any difference.
Oh, it does.
Does it?
You got to follow clues, okay, which tell you what direction, east or west, that kind of stuff, right?
Oh, right, because yeah, it would just be the opposite, wouldn't
it? Well, that's why nobody could find Atlantis. They were still using our north-south as it is today. When you flip it upside down, everything becomes very clear. Everything.
Ah,
I proved Plato's account right down to the period on his work. It's great.
Oh, my God. Well, okay, back to the
Let's do Garden of Eden first.
Yeah, let's do that, because I'm fascinated, because I'll tell you, Stan, I even look for it myself many times on Google Earth. And I've never been able to find it, so you go first.
Well, all right. As I said, put everything back together and make the Earth, 25% smaller than it is now, and start looking for clues. And you go to Genesis 2:8-14, and it says, "And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed." Well, I read it in the Hebrew, which is slightly different from this. It's more informative of the actual directions and places.
Right.
Now, everybody thought, since Moses was writing this down as God told him over in, the area of Jordan, that kind of stuff, where the tribes were, that he was talking about eastward from there, over toward Iran and, Syria and that kind of stuff. But that's not it. The Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden. Okay. He was in the land of Eden, God was. And in the east of Eden was where he put the garden. Now, I used Egyptian records, I used Velikovsky, I used the Bible or the Torah, in Hebrew to trace it. And here are some clues. Genesis 2:9 says, "And up out of the ground," get that, up out of the ground.
Right.
It's like a tree, has the trunk and it makes all the branches up. That's the same kind of meaning that up out of the ground in Hebrew means. It came up like a geyser, up out of the ground. And he made the up out of the ground, the Lord made to grow every tree. They're growing up like that, and blah, blah, blah. And then you go to Genesis 2:10, "And a river went up out of the land of Eden to water the garden of Eden. And from there it was parted and became four headwaters." Now, every account I have read and looked at since then and before then says, okay, here's four rivers. We found them over in the Euphrates Valley. Some of them you had to use a satellite to see because they're buried in sand, that kind of stuff.
Right,
and
right.
It puts the Garden of Eden down in the Persian Gulf. Or it puts
exactly.
It over,
Yeah.
Okay, and I said to them, wait a minute. It says the rivers started there and flowed out, down. The Persian Gulf is down low. All the stuff you're talking about is running backwards. It's not right. So I said, we've got to have a high ground where four massive rivers came from. And so Genesis 2:11 says, "The name of the first river is the Pishon. And it is the river that goes around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold." And Genesis 2:12 says, "And the gold of that land is good. There is bdellium and the onyx stone." Well, that was so long ago. This is being told to Moses, and he's obviously got to know where the land of Havilah is, known for gold, and this bdellium is like Arabic gums, like incense, and that kind of stuff.
Right, exactly.
Onyx is a nice, colorful stone. So I thought, all right, I'm going to look on the map and look on the internet, which countries in the Middle East are known for onyx and bdellium, gum oils and stuff like that, incense, or frankincense and other oils. They're gum oils on the trees, and are known for gold. And in the doing of that, I found that there was, when all the countries, continents were together, that there was a band, kind of an equatorial band, that went from Central America straight through Africa, straight through Tanzania, straight through Madagascar, which was connected to Africa at the time, into the middle of India. And all those places are known for gold. Lots of gold. Oh. The Karnataka region of India, the South
yes.
American gold, okay, the cities of gold, Cibola, okay, and Tanzania and Madagascar are really known for gold. In fact, Madagascar is the best gold in the world, but I'll tell you about that a little bit later.
Okay,
so this is River 1, the Pishon. It goes around Havilah. Well, now Havilah, I was looking and, I found that there were descendants of Peleg, I think it was, anyway, that... descendants of Joktan in the Bible, and his descendants, there was Jobab, there was Havilah, Ophir, Sheba, Abimel, and Obal. But Havilah was a descendant of Shem after the flood, you know, three or four generations later, through Joktan.
Correct.
Now, Joktan, I have to tell you, Joktan is the English form, and this is why it's important to study these clues in the actual language. Joktan in Hebrew is pronounced Yucatan.
Oh, interesting.
Now, the Yucatan Peninsula, I checked with the history over there. No one knows why they call it the Yucatan Peninsula. It used to join to Africa right at the Rock of Gibraltar, and that was where the ancient land of ancient Libya was. Yucatan, one of the four sons of Noah, settled in that area, and one of his children, Havilah, went down into Africa and settled there, and Ophir did too. I found their location along the northeastern coast of Africa. Now, when I did that, then I said, okay, so Havilah had gold, and he came after Ophir, and the land is here. Okay, now that's starting to identify that there was a river around this Havilah place. And I thought, I don't see one. I mean, there's a lot of rivers in Africa, but on the eastern coast there, let me put Madagascar on my computer up next to Africa where it used to live. And suddenly I saw, right, when India and Madagascar were crunched together and connected by, you know, rivers to mm-hmm. Africa, if you go inland from where Madagascar was, you see a river that goes around all of the island now of Madagascar and up into the interior of Tanzania.
Okay,
hold that thought. Genesis 2:13 says, the name of the second river that tells you where the Garden of Eden is Gihon. The name is the same as that country which encompasses the whole land of Ethiopia. Now, so it says the Gihon, the second river, goes all around Ethiopia. In the English Bible, it says Ethiopia. In the Hebrew, it says the land of Cush with a K, not a C. Cush with a C is in Northeast Africa. That's a well-known fact. So I said, all right, maybe they left a clue to where this Cush was around their country by naming things with a K or a Q, Kashan, Kushan, Kush, Kashite, something like that. And I found over 150 of these places surrounding and in the interior of Iran and part of Pakistan and Afghanistan. All of Iran primarily was the ancient Kushites. So a river had to go around Iran. Okay, I found that one. Genesis 2:14 comes along and says, and the name of the third river is the Hiddekel, or the Tigris, and it goes toward the east of Assyria, and it's actually east of the town of Asher that Shalmaneser the First built. And the fourth river is the Euphrates.
Right.
Now, I had to find the third and fourth river. Okay, the Euphrates and the Tigris in English, you see them, you read it on the map. Euphrates comes in from the northwest down into the valley there, all the way down to the Persian Gulf, and the Tigris is over to the east of ancient Asher, and comes down the same kind of valley. Well, another little clue in the Bible, again in the original language, is when they talk about the river Euphrates in the ancient document, they say the river Euphrates. It's like saying the river Euphrates. And so I got with some rabbinical scholars and I said, why did they repeat that? Would they think we're stupid? No, he says, this is the way the ancients pluralized a word. They didn't add an S. They put bang, bang, you know, or house meant houses. And I said, well, how many houses? Well, it just meant there was more than one. I said, well, that's a help. And I thought, okay, the river Euphrates is part of the border that was given to Abraham by God as part of the border of his territory. And so I used that map, description in Genesis, and I thought, right, the Euphrates is broken up. It used to be one great river coming from the garden. Let me track the Euphrates back up into the border between Turkey and Syria and out along the coastline of the Levant, where Israel and Lebanon are, and it comes over to either the Red Sea or the my mind's gone blank. The river of Egypt.
The Nile.
The Nile.
Yeah.
And they're just a few miles apart, but I trace both of those rivers a mile at a time on close-up Google Earth down in the ground where I can count trees, right? And I trace them at a mile at a time going up to where their headwaters were. So either one of them will work because they both come to the same place in northern Tanzania. So I found Euphrates, and then the harder one was the Tigris, because it came from up in the mountains. Let's see, the southwestern part of Iran. There was the other river that went around Iran and part of India, but where the Indus is now. But these two rivers, the Gihon and the Hiddekel, were close together, but they, you know, were broken up as well. Anyway, so I found the riverbeds. I traced all through Iran, you know, again, you know, mile at a time, found nuclear test zones, all kinds of stuff, but I found the riverbeds. Now, I noticed when I was doing this that Iran and India had a lot of wrinkles in them, like the land had been shoved over toward China to make the Himalayas and stuff like that. And I thought, that's pretty weird. Okay, then when these continents were all together, when I try to put India over to Africa, just like it is today, it doesn't fit. And then I looked I looked down at the bottom of the seabed between North Africa and the Saudi Peninsula and India and a part of Iran, and I realized from the stretch marks, you can go see this on Google Earth, the stretch marks show that those continents fit together, and India was shoved, the surface of India was shoved up to form the Himalayas, and part of Iran was too, by something. Well, I put that on the, okay, I'll find that something in a minute. Let's track the riverbeds around from, you know, from Iran and from the valley there that goes into the Persian Gulf where the Euphrates and the Hiddekel and the Tigris are. And I've traced them all back. Three of the rivers come together over in Northeast Africa and enter into one spot that's an altitude of 10,000 feet. And, I realized, wait a minute, that's high enough. And, well, I'm going to get Google Earth and zoom in on this and get right down to the business of this place. It was in the middle of about 45 volcanoes in a large field in Tanzania. This is interesting because the Bible mentions that Satan walked amongst the hot stones of Eden. This would certainly be hot stones with all these volcanic eruptions that occurred there in the past. That's only three rivers. They come to one spot right at the top end of this one volcano. I thought, okay, I need a fourth one. And then I saw that on probably 20 miles apart from where those three headwaters came together, there was another massive river that formed down the slopes of the outside of this volcanic cone that has collapsed, and it goes around, guess what, the Madagascar island that was separated from Africa. So I'd found the four rivers. And when I looked at where the three major ones came from, and part of the fourth one came from the same spot, it ran down into a little cup and then down over the side. It's in a place today that's like 20 acres big, in the top of all this formation, out on the northern edge of it, which is it's like a geyser. It bursts up water, but in the past, it used to shoot it high up into the air, and it was warm water because it was being fed with the lake water and underground water from the Lake Victoria to the west of there, and the huge volcanic activity all around it heated the water, blew it up into the air, cooled it, and of course it fell down and formed the erosion channels that went down through the Great East African Rift and either the Nile or the Red Sea, and then down around Madagascar. So I found it, and it came up out of the ground, just like the word said. It shot up and sprayed out like tree limbs. And then fell and then became the headwaters of four rivers. So that was it. And when I traced back to this place, I drew the screen, you know, I shrunk it down so I could see the big picture. And this place was called the Ngorongoro Crater in the local language, which means big hole, actually. Ngorongoro means big holes, plural, just like the Hebrew plural Ngorongoro. And it's 100 square miles in diameter, or in area. And its walls are all still intact today, and 25,000 large mammals still live there. And in Africa, they call it Africa's Garden of Eden. The ABC did a Good Morning American show for 2 or 3 hours live from there with drones flying over saying, this is Africa's Garden of Eden. Now, this is a few months after I'd sent the ABC my discovery, and they never.
Oh, so they basically picked up on your story and ran with it without you.
Yeah,
which is fine.
That's
right?
Fine. That's fine.
You know,
and you know, but anyway, that is the Garden of Eden, and there are all kinds of animals and life forms that, you know, just live there, and the Maasai live just outside of it, and the older tribe that was there for 1300 BC up until probably, I don't know, 400 or 500 years ago. No, 200 years ago, I guess. The older tribe was pushed out by the Maasai when the Germans kicked them out of where they lived over in Kenya and put them over into Tanzania. But the older tribe, when I looked into their legends, they said, since they used to live around the Ngorongoro crater, they said, this is where man was made, inside the crater. God came down from the sky, landed in here, made man, put him outside of the garden, and then went back up into the heavens. Now, this is their tribal legend.
Wow. See, now this is amazing. Have you ever heard of a tribal leader by the name of, Credo? I can't think of his name right now. Anyhow, there's an African leader that was there. I think he might still be alive, that has said the same thing you're saying right now.
No.
He also said that they were part reptilian, which is very interesting to me. That they came out of the heat and they were formed and they were part animal. They weren't just all human. And we're talking today about the Garden of Eden. We're going to talk a little bit about Atlantis. But before we get to Atlantis, we're going to finish up Garden of Eden, which Stan has discovered. And I'm looking at the map right now. It's in Tanzania. It's in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. And it's amazing that he figured this all out. But my God, it makes total sense. And I was just telling him, I couldn't remember the name of the person, but it's Credo Mutra. And he is a, I believe he lives in Zimbabwe, but he could be Mozambique. He is an elderly shaman for the tribe there, and he has always talked about that whole area of Tanzania, Mozambique, that whole Kenya, Uganda, as being the seat of God. That's where man was created, and he said that about the African people, that that's where they came from, is that area, which I find fascinating that Stan was able to figure this out too. So, Stan, we were talking right before the break about, I said to you something about reptilians, and then you had something great to say, and then I texted you about what I had discovered from a friend of mine. So, anyhow, so go ahead. What were you going to say about that?
Well, yes, in keeping with what what he said about the first men, or the original men there in Africa, North Africa, having reptilian parts to their body.
Exactly, yeah.
You'll remember that a snake is a reptile, and they called Satan the reptile that tempted Eve. And that was there in Ngorongoro crater. Now, this is definitely the site that God created man, because just right on the northeast edge of it is a volcano called Oldoinyo, which means the mountain of God. Referenced in the ancient text, it's not the one that people think over in the Middle East. This one here is definitely the one where God created man. Now, Satan traversed the area, and he had reptilian blood. We know that from the description in the Hebrew. Now, this is part of the Atlantis discussion, the discovery of that, because the children of Adam and Eve migrated up or down through the Great East African Rift from Tanzania, down in and across a little bay, to Saudi Arabia, which was it was the major part of Atlantis. And that's where the fallen ones, who were described as Nephilim in the Genesis 6 account, came down and crossbred with our women. And they created hybrid giants. Now, UFO reports and stuff, abduction reports, talk about these tall, Nordic-looking humans that are, you know, supposedly our elder brothers in space and that kind of stuff. But these are fallen ones or either hybrids. Because when I was in the program with Dr. Teller down in Australia years ago, I was told about these beings. They were fair-skinned, like Nordic Viking-type people. And if you looked at their hands or their arms in the sunlight just right, it would glisten like a rainbow sheen on an oil slick. And it was from very tiny scales that formed their skin. So this kind of reptilian stuff resonates with me. I won't argue with the guy. I think it's true.
I agree. You know, because too many people have come to me because I'm very much involved in the whole UFO community. And a lot of these people have been telling me, you know, it's not what you think. It's not scales like on a snake, except for maybe their belly where you can't really see it very well if it's all white. And I go, huh, that's interesting, you know, and more people are coming out with this. So when you said that, I was absolutely floored that you'd heard this as well. So it's very interesting stuff, I'm telling you. It isn't like, you know, the gross reptilian with all the scales and the horns and all that. I mean, maybe it is, too. Maybe there's another whole breed of those. But there's definitely some kind of human hybrid reptilian genetics involved here. I absolutely believe
well,
that.
Well, let me tell you this. Several years ago, a woman biologist started tracing the mitochondrial DNA of women back to a common origin point. Every one of them, they all came back to one spot about 300 miles from the Ngoro crater in the Omo Valley, where the oldest known bones of humans have been found. And from there, they all branched out to all the continents. Of course, they were all closer together than they are now. But that'll tell you right there that the mitochondrial DNA, the one they call the Eve of her research, all came from that spot. And when Adam and Eve were taken out of the Garden of Eden, placed down into the surrounding territory, that led right into the Omo Valley.
You know, Stan, there's something I've never been able to quite figure out. They always say they banned them from the Garden of Eden, and they went to live with other humans. And, you know, all the people I talk to that read this in the Bible go, where were these other humans created? Where did they come from? And they have no answers for that. At least the preachers at the churches I go to have never had an answer for that. What's your answer to that?
Well, it's a tricky question, a tricky answer too. But the Earth had the Adamic man, which was different than the indigenous, you know, Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal and those kind of things. They may have been part of an original test or pilot that God did or allowed to happen by Satan, who apparently before the Genesis 1 chapter, you know, before when the earth was waste and void, before there was a living civilization on the planet. We think that one of the reasons that Satan was kicked out and his followers was that they were breeding with, probably like with apes, crossing the DNA to try to form an army, you know, to resist God.
And Stan, I don't mean to interrupt you, but at this point, do you actually mean breeding, like having sex, or are you
talking about scientific
engineering?
Oh, just engineered, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
okay.
Well, look, Cain kills his brother, right? And he is marked on his forehead with a blood mark. You can't kill this man, okay? He goes east of Eden.
Yep.
And finds a woman to marry in a foreign country, in a land of Nud.
That's
right. Nud is a future tense of a Hebrew verb, an ancient Hebrew verb, which means the men shall wander as fugitives. And if you look in the Indus Valley, Indus is part of the same conjugation of future tense. That's India. So India had to be east of Eden, which was Tanzania, right there. You see when it's all together. When he did that, his tribe put the blood mark on their forehead. And if you notice, they don't know where the bindi, the red forehead mark in the Hindu culture, came from. It's just always been there.
That's true. I've always wondered about that, and no one's been able to give me an answer. So
well,
that's very interesting.
Hindu is Indu, the same thing as Indus River Valley, coming from the Hebrew verb, the men shall wander as fugitives. I think Shalcot, which he built for his son, is up the Indus River Valley and up into the mountains there between there and Pakistan. But anyway, that's a digress, but that's how he married someone else, okay? They were already there.
Cool. See, I've been going, you know, where did all these people come from? Because I know we had there's got to be other people here besides Adam and Eve and the kids, right?
I mean, I got to tell you that the Indian mathematics and the Indian mind is really, really quite brilliant. Some of our most brilliant mathematicians have come out of India and writings and stuff. So there was a good bloodline there in spite of it probably coming from Cain. Now, here's some I've got to explain partially now. The Bible tells us that, in English, that the flood of Noah destroyed all life on the planet except him and what was on his boat.
Right.
This is not what it says in Hebrew. It says...
Right. I thank you for bringing that up. That's what I wanted to talk to you about tonight, because I know you were a Noah, you know, flood guy. So, a Noah flood guy.
Well, think about the evidence that they found around Alaska and around Canada coastlines and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Swirled graveyards of animals of all kind, big animals, swirled into a common graveyard and deposited in a lump. Now, if the water is rising up, they might drown, but they're not going to get swirled together. Something had to move the water.
Exactly.
And it had to move the water over the land and push them there. I found what it was. It's a huge asteroid that hit on the eastern side of India in what's called the Kutupa Basin now. And it was it's an interesting story on that all by itself. But anyway, the land, or the word for world that they use, was Haaretz, the earth or the dirt, or the country, or the land. It has so many meanings that you had to know what they were talking about. And it's where the flesh had become corrupt and the ways had become evil. And this is the magic part of this. Atlantis was real. Atlantis was who was killed by the flood because they were breeding with humans and making corrupt DNA.
Now, okay, so these are satanic fallen angels? Followers of Lucifer, basically.
Well, yeah, and there were 12 of them, according to Plato's writings, that were descended to Earth and divided the Earth up into 12 regions, and each took a region. One of them took what we call Atlantis, because that's the surviving record, and that guy's name in the Greek was Poseidon. Now, I found where he built his castle. It's there today, covered up about 30 or 40 feet of mud and sand, but it's still there.
Wow.
Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
Where can I see it on Google Maps?
look for I'll tell you the place, but we have to use a NASA satellite image, 3D image, to see it from space.
Okay.
But it is there. It's called the Island of Damam, D-A-M-A, D-A-M-M-A-M, Damam. And that's where the first oil strike for Saudi Arabia was found after World War II.
Oh, interesting.
On the ashes of Poseidon, who was, you know, a fallen one, Arabia builds its wealth, and of course Arabia is going to figure heavily, you'll see in Holly's book Prophetic Perils, in the invasion and the war against Israel very shortly, and they will be, you know, their army will be absolutely decimated, but that's the attack coming. And strangely enough, the guy that's going to do it is young Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which is from the ancient Arabic and Akkadian. It's Solomon, has been anglicized, but it was Shalmaneser, or Shalman, or Solomon the Great. And this is 200 or 300 years before King Solomon was even born. That's another whole story in itself, how he got named that. But still, it's a Solomon, and the Revelation in the Bible tells us about here wisdom is. It's the number of a man, and it's the name of a man. And 666 was how he got, you know, his... the number of him. And when you trace that back in the Old Testament, you find that King Solomon was the only one that earned 666 talents of gold a year, and he was the wisest man known in their history, in the Bible. And although he did go bad, he did apparently repent at the end of his life and, you know, follow God again. But in the time that he was, you know, backslidden, shall we say, King Solomon was a bad dude. And so we're seeing that a new Solomon with gold and with Middle East connections and power will be you know, part of the invading forces of Israel and will be defeated. Young King Solomon has already formed a 34 nation Arabic confederacy to fight, in his words, ISIS. But this is strange because the Saud family, which is bin Salman's family, bin Salman al Saud, they have financed a lot of people like Osama bin Laden and stuff, and a lot of terrorism that hurt the United States. We know
right.
that. So for him to turn on Israel is not a stretch of the mind. It's such a collection of rabbit holes to dive down. I have to kind of pull me back and say, okay.
Well, yeah, because, you know, it seems interesting that he would even, you know, why would the family care at this point? I mean, why would they even bother? Because, you know, we've got so many countries involved in all this. Would they leave it to the politicians instead of the family to be dealing with it? I mean,
the family, sorry, what family?
Yeah, the tribe, the family of this gentleman.
Saud, the Saud family?
Yeah, Saud family.
Oh, look.
Are they becoming like a new representative of their country? I mean,
well, yes, King Salman is in charge of Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's his country. And his son,
right.
Prince Salman, is geared to take over. However, he's not next in line.
I get it. I was going, wait a minute. I thought he was in charge, but you were saying something about the younger one. And I'm like, okay, I'm confused. But hey, it's just me. I'm confused easily.
Well, his cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef, is the number one to take over when King Salman, the current King Salman, dies. And he's ancient. He's losing his memory, Alzheimer's and stuff. But he has delegated all these portfolios of major control to his son, who he favors, rather than the son's cousin, Bin Nayef.
Okay.
Anyway, that's, as I say, that's another story. But that power group is forming over. He's united the Gulf States nations, like Oman. All those together with these others to form a 34-nation military confederation. They've even had practice drills with their militaries. He is a strong force over there. His name is Salman, and he is rich in gold. That country is massive. And the Saud family has invested into two mines in the Red Sea off the west coast of Saudi Arabia, and they are called Atlantis 1 and Atlantis 2. Tell me they
what?
Don't know.
That's seriously?
Right. Absolutely.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You were talking about this, and I was, pulling in on the Bahrain and Qatar and all this, and guess what I came up with? The Coral Island. Have you seen this?
The one they built, you mean, for that?
Yeah, it looks like a little Tower of Babel or something. It's so interesting. I was like, why did they build that thing? Anyhow, it's very cool. Have you seen it?
I think I know the one you're talking about. Is it the one where they've raised up the seabed, made the palm leaves, and built houses on it?
No, it's a little island off of the town of, let's see, is it Qatar? Let me hold on a minute here. It is in Dammam, Saudi Arabia. It's on Cornish Road, and it's near Dolphin Village in Bahrain.
Bahrain,
and it's this coral castle that is spiral, and it looks like a little Tower of Babel. It's the only thing I can describe it. It's very interesting, and why it's there, I have no idea. It's just there. It's crazy.
Well, I don't know. That I ran across that. I've been all over Bahrain and Bahrain.
Yeah,
and
everybody look this up. It's called Coral Island in Dammam, Saudi Arabia. And it's on Cornish Road. It's open 24 hours a day.
Wait a minute. I think I know the one you're talking about. It's is it in Bahrain or is it in – well, Dammam is different than Bahrain. Dammam is just about 20 miles up the coast, I think.
Yes, exactly. But it's in Dammam. It is. It's definitely not in Bahrain. It's in Dammam. And it just – anyhow, folks, I was looking for what Stan was talking about, and somehow I got taken to this thing, and I'm going, wow, this is really bizarre. So I thought you guys might enjoy looking at it. It's very beautiful, but it's built in a spiral, and it's just a trip. So check it out, folks. It's something I've never seen before. It's called the Coral Island. Anyhow, back to what we were talking about. So now these countries, they're forming. We've got gold. We've got money. We got power. What is it you think they're going to be able to accomplish? Because it sounds to me like they're not going to be able to accomplish anything. So what what do you think the end game is for these guys?
Well, the end game is, certainly Iran has espoused this, they want Israel gone. And, of course, the Palestinians do. And most of the neighboring Arab states are unified in the thought that we're going to get rid of Israel.
Correct.
Okay, yeah. Now, they're clever. They've gotten away with a lot over the past that people didn't even know about. But they've been putting money into our presidential elections for a long time.
Yes, they have.
They have.
Yeah. And
now,
we can look back at the Carlyle Group for just the beginnings of the Bush administration for that one. But anyhow, go ahead.
Yeah. So here they are. They have been influencing politicians and economies all over the planet. Now, they knew a long time ago that their oil would eventually run out and they would have just sand left. You can't sell sand. So they thought, right, we'll invest in corporations all over the planet and in governments, and we'll control the rest of the world. In the meantime, we'll let them use the oil. But we'll start in Mohammed bin Salman, the young prince, is now doing this, taking Saudi Arabia off the oil economy, going into gold and tourism. They're going to turn Saudi Arabia into Atlantis for real. And there's more to it than that. He lives in Riyadh, right in the middle of it, which is just kind of in the middle of what was Atlantis Island. It was 1.3 square million square miles. It was big, the main island.
Wow, seriously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When the asteroid,
my God.
When the asteroid hit, Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, all the way up to Aleppo, to the border between Syria and Turkey, that was surrounding water. The Mediterranean, the Red Sea, all of that went around all of Saudi Arabian Peninsula. In fact, Lawrence of Arabia, who was a writer as well, after he finished his military stuff with the sheikhs there, he was in search of the Atlantis of the Sands. He wrote about it.
Oh.
He knew. And the Bedouin said, yes, we used to be an island. All of Saudi Arabia used to be an island. They can, their legends tell them this. It's not tens of thousands of years ago. And there are, I found over 1,400 stone artifacts that were made, you know, 200 feet, 400 feet long, and that kind of stuff. Exactly the same scale all over parts of Saudi Arabia, in the northwest and toward the mountains. And there's more. I just found these on Google Earth. When asked what these are, the Bedouin say, they were left by the old men. And that's their way of saying in the olden times. The men of the olden times built those. And I know what they mean. And no one else, the archaeologists, don't know why these straight lines with a little circle at the end with a little island in the middle of that means. It was a symbol for Poseidon's island.
How interesting.
And you'll look at Stonehenge. You'll look at the Gilgal circles of the giants in the Golan Heights. All of them have those three rings
That's
of water
right.
land. You know, they're remembering. In fact, I even found this carved into Hopi prophecy rocks. The same thing saying how many sons Poseidon had with 10 stars on his back with water, two streams of water coming out of his hat left and right. Looks like a joker's hat. But Poseidon pulled up two streams of water, one hot and one cold, from the earth to water his island. And it's all there in the Hopi stuff, too.
That is very interesting. And now, was Baghdad included in this, or was that the northern tip? Was Turkey involved? I mean...
In Atlantis?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, according to Plato,
and Iran?
According to Plato and the Egyptian records at the port of Sais, the Atlanteans had sway over the Mediterranean shoreline all the way up to the Rock of Gibraltar, to the Straits of Gibraltar. That, by the way, is not the Pillars of Hercules or that kind of stuff. It's nonsense. It's in the opposite direction.
Oh, okay.
But it
was
ancient Libya and Asia Minor. They had influence. They were in between. They had influence all through there, and they were moving their bases up into the Sea of Greece. What is that called? The Ionian Sea. Anyway, where Santorini is. And they had a base up in Spain, and we think they went further up into Europe from what Plato put together. So they – and this is good. James Cameron, the film producer, has just recently released on the History Channel his documentary about finding Atlantis. He sent a guy over to do
really?
It. Oh, yeah. And he didn't.
I didn't know anything about
this. Look up James Cameron Atlantis and Sardinia. It's an island just close to Italy there in the middle of the Mediterranean called Sardinia. And he filmed, his investigator filmed, a lot of these ancient rock castles and little houses with circles around them all around these things. And the legend in the locals was, the ancient time these were giants, and we have dug up their bones before, but the Catholic Church builds a church over the top of these sites, and we can't see the bones anymore. And I understand why they did that, because it's evil, it's the fallen ones and that kind of stuff, so they wanted to hide it because it was bad news. But they're now making new digs, and they're going to be bringing up new giant bones. And these beings were hybrids from Atlantis. They were an outpost in the Mediterranean. It all fits so incredibly well that your jaw has to drop.
Well, now, Stan, does this relate to the red-headed giants that we have in America?
Look. Remember, all the continents were together, and it wasn't just Atlantis under Poseidon. There were 11 other fallen kings, from the heavens.
That's right.
And they had territory over there, and they crossbred. Of course it does.
Yeah, and so America actually had one of these colonies on it, is what you're saying.
Two, America and North America. Look at the pyramids that the Mayans and the Aztecs built after the ancient ones, right? They were kind of, they were four-sided pyramids, and they had flat tops and little observatories. these were in the, you know, you see them start in the Yucatan Peninsula. Remember Yucatan that was over in
yep.
there? Okay. If you look at the pyramids of Egypt, Yucatan looked at these, Yucatan, and he said, right, okay, and he taught his sons, and he went on over to settle in the Yucatan Peninsula and took the technology of the pyramids with him. His sons and others went over into Asia, and they took the concept of pyramids, and they all had different little surface differences as far as the archaeology and decorations, but basically they were four-sided pyramids, and they all started there in the Middle East in the Atlantean culture there.
Isn't that interesting? Man, I had no clue about this one at all. This is so intriguing to me. You know, we're going to hit a break here in a couple of minutes. So what other discoveries have you come across? What about Noah and the flood? And besides Atlantis, how did you find out about the asteroid? And did you find anything else about Noah and the family? Is there any more going on with that? I'm so intrigued by it.
Well, okay, we can start. You can tell me when we've got to go to break. But the thing I was telling you about with all the swirling water that killed life forms and mammoths and tigers and shoved them into big swirling, that had to be water moving across the earth. The flood did not destroy the whole planet, but it sent tidal waves, or tsunamis more accurately, at high speed sweeping around the planet several times after an asteroid that I've measured at about 10 to 12 miles in diameter hit at a shallow angle on the east coast of India, and it shoved Australia down to where it is now, and it shoved Indonesia and New Guinea over to where they are now. By the impact, it moved 6 million square miles of seabed and mantle away from the where the west side of India is now, over underneath New Guinea in that area, and left a huge deposit of 6 million square miles of raised area in the surface of the earth. It's the only kind of dent and pimple in the earth that, you know, that we have. It's huge. And
well, what about the one in South America that they all protect? You know, they all the scientists say this is the one that killed off the dinosaurs.
No, it was the one in, they're talking about the one in the Gulf of Mexico. Chicxulub. That one is tiny. That one had an outer rim of its impact crater of 100-mile diameter. The one I'm talking about had a 250-mile diameter.
Oh, my God.
And I originally looked at the Chicxulub and I said, that's the one. It hit straight on, and the shockwave was bounced inside the planet and came up underneath India, and that's why it separated the continent so rapidly over there. But it wasn't. I corrected myself after I'd done the lecture. I found that there was a local asteroid impact. In fact, I found five more, but a local asteroid impact, it was huge. The biggest one it's ever going to be discovered so far, and they haven't given me credit for it yet, but they will. I'm working with the geologists now in a couple of countries to have them test what I've told them.
Oh, wow, cool. I love that. Stan, are they going to name it after you, the Dale Crater?
No, I don't think so. It's more appropriately called the Kudapa meteor or Kudapa asteroid, because it's the Kudapa Basin of India, and the geologists over there know that something hit offshore. They couldn't find it, and I got with the Scripps Institute in California, and they gave me a very high-resolution mud map of the seabeds before they even let Google Earth have it for me to try, and I found the impact crater. The angle it came in was 34 degrees. I found the vector of it, and I found where it stopped over and formed the Banda Sea. The Banda Sea north of okay, that is where it came to a sliding stop and pushed stuff up ahead of it. It tunneled under the surface of the earth. Now, I've had the oil industry geologists over in the Middle East. I've had one of them ring me up on the iPad from Mongolia out there in the boonies, and he said, I just heard what you were saying on this lecture.
We've hit the break, so I want to hear what this guy said to you.
We'll come back to Troy after the break. Okay.
We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone, to the Fenton Perspective here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I am your host, Lorian Fenton, and I want to thank Stan Dale for being with us here today. It's just fascinating. I could sit here and just listen for hours to Stan. It's amazing the information he has. But before we get back to Stan, I want to read one thing quickly, and then I'm going to ask Stan to tell you all about how to get a hold of Dare to Prepare, Garden Gold, all the books they've got on the website. And I just want to say one thing quickly before we we get to all that, if you guys want to give somebody the best gift of their life, I swear to you, get them Dare to Prepare. The new version's out, the fifth edition. I think it was 2013 or 14 it came out. Let me look. Anyhow, it is the best book on the market. And here's a little hint for you guys. If you buy a case of books, I think there's 8 or 10 in the case. I can't remember. I think Stan's given like a 30 or 40% discount. You could buy 8 books, 8 or 10 books. I think it's 8. 8 books. Let me go to the website. Let me look real quick.
That's right. 8 books, 40%
off. Is it 8 books?
Yep.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Dan. I'm doing this from memory. I got to get back to the webpage. And if you buy that and you give all your friends and family that book, it's the best thing you could do for your loved ones. I'm telling you, folks, I would not tell you, I have not told you ever to buy a book like this ever on my show, but I'm telling you now, this is the book to get, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart. It's the best book I've ever read on prepping. It's huge. It's monstrous. It is. It got pictures. It is like the best book on the planet. And you know what can I say? This is the book to get your friends and family, especially now. You know, back in 2000, I was thinking, oh, I got to have 20 copies of this around, but nothing happened. And so here we are, but things are getting really wacky and crazy out there, folks. So I want you to get this book. If you do nothing else by listening to the show today, get Dare to Prepare by Holly Deo. It is the best book out there. Anyhow, so Stan, before we get to what we were talking about, your friend calling you from Madagascar or wherever he was calling you from, I want you to tell everybody on the website all about what you've got available for them on the website, including L.A. Marzulli's books. And by the way, L.A. was down at our TV studio in L.A. doing an interview with us this past week.
Oh, was he?
So, yeah, I just got to, I got to say hi to him. I got to hang out with him for a while. It was lots of fun. He's a great guy. And yeah, we just had a blast. He did our TV show, and it was wonderful. He did a great interview. So we'll have to have you down on there sometime, you and Holly, on our television show, and I'll tell you more about it at another date. But in the meantime, tell everybody about the website, because what happens to me is the show ends, and we don't get any of this in. So let's just do it now.
Oh, okay. Well, you can just go to our main website, standeo.com, and you'll see the news that Holly updates 5 days a week. Well, sometimes 6 days a week. She's up about 4 o'clock in the morning and starts putting the stuff together that's important for people that are thinking and aware and seeing what's happening around the world. And our books are listed there. Her latest book, Prophetic Perils, Dare to Prepare, is, you know, that's a staple book for.
It is. Yeah. Everybody has to have that book. Period.
And if you're going to grow, if we, you know, have growing conditions that still work for us, Garden Gold is an e-book. You can just pull it on down. Prudent Places USA tells about, it's a CD-ROM. But you can download it onto your computer. It tells about all the major cities and counties in the United States. There's over 3,100 of them. It tells all the pluses and minuses of living in those areas. And there are about 72 factors that she puts around each county and some of the major cities, telling you whether it's earthquake-prone, whether it's flood, whether it would be a good place to live during a Russian invasion, prices of property, political distribution, that kind of stuff. Very good to know about your neighborhood in the times coming, because you may have to meet a lot of them suddenly. And the DVD on King Solomon and the Antichrist of this age and the Garden of Eden, that's there. It's called the Lectures and the Lectures and Interviews of Stan Deo Volume 1, and that's on the shopping cart. Those are all kind of like self-describing things on the shopping cart. There are a few other books there on Townsend Brown and a lot of stuff that I put together that no one had seen from when he was in France. And we have, Garden Secrets.
Yeah, don't forget to tell people to get their 3D glasses so they can see your cool stuff on the website.
Well, it's all right. I've been putting it in. I think we're about out of those now, but it's only for one folder of images that I had from there that are in 3D. It was fun.
It's fun, I got to say.
Get your, red and green glasses out of a cereal box or some of those paper ones. They'll work just fine.
Yeah, no, they're fun. I brought out my pair I got from a movie I went and saw, and I was looking at the website. I was thinking, this is so much fun to look at 3D images on my computer. I couldn't stand it. It was great. It was great fun. So, okay, folks, so you know what to do. You go to standeo.com, that's S-T-A-N-D-E-Y-O.com, and check out all the things they have there. And like I said, Dare to Prepare is my favorite. It's the one you buy 20 or 30, 40 copies. You hand them out to everybody you love, and you make sure they have a copy of it because it's kind of like next to your Bible type of thing. You got to have it in the house. You got to have it ready because you're going to be looking up things you just never even knew you thought you'd be looking up in there. I'll tell you that. I have many a time. So there you go. Okay, Stan, one thing before we get back to what we were talking about. My buddy Ken Sendo, who lived in India for a very long time, he said that in India, the version of the Vermilion Mark is as follows. In order to grow tribes, the men would raid other tribes to get new brides and bloodlines. When kidnapping the bride, they hit her on the head. Often blood would come dripping down the forehead. It is a common story in Bengal and northeast India, where the Vermilion Mark extends all the way to the crown of the head. And so that's what their version of the Bindi.
Bindi.
Yeah.
I saw that as one of the versions of it, but I still have my wonders about it because it's a blood mark, and you know, it was choosing a bride and having children by that bride. It means a married woman, and maybe it didn't happen the way I suspect, but
It did, and maybe yours is the oldest version of, and it changed over the centuries, and believe me, it's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years, so believe me, it changed.
Well, you know, think about this. If the flood had wiped out everyone, why would sons of Noah go down into what is India and one of them put a blood mark on his head?
Exactly.
But they did survive, and the impact of that asteroid. I was telling you about the contact with the petroleum geologist in Mongolia. Anyway, he rang me up on the iPad, and we Skyped for a long time, actually. He says, look, I'm going to send you a PowerPoint presentation I made to the industry here recently. He says, I've been over in Saudi Arabia and in Oman investigating something. None of them could figure out how it happened. And originally, there was a 10,000-foot deep layer of seabed and mantle. It's called ophiolite. Deposit over Oman and parts of southern Saudi Arabia. In fact, so much that it weighed down the Saudi Peninsula, the Saudi island in the old days, and shoved that end down into the seabed and raised up the other end in the Mediterranean side 1,650 feet, which is why people...
Wow.
Yeah, and he said, look, your asteroid, the location you've got, the size of it, the impact, and that great huge divot out of the seabed of India... It's the right thing. We couldn't find the asteroid. Thank you very much. And so he's running off now to tell everybody. So it is real. And it was an asteroid impact so huge that it could have, well, it was almost a total extinction level event, but tribes of people all over the place did survive. And that's why when Moses went into the Promised Land, he sent the tribes of Israel in there, he stayed out. Under Joshua, they were to kill certain tribes, all the animals, all the people, the babies, everything that was living. Because they were still giants and corrupt flesh that survived the flood.
Okay.
God was having a mop-up operation.
Wow. That's just...
If you think giants didn't exist after the flood, think about Goliath and his four brothers, and think about Og, the king of Bashan, who slept in a bed that was 18 feet long.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, we know they survived. My God. Yeah, but, you know, the whole thing that's always bothered me about the whole thing, Stan, is why... You know, why kill us too? But, you know, hey, maybe we weren't the best of humans at the time. I don't know.
No, what they were wiping out primarily was the hybrid beings and people who had become, you know, well, very wicked following the ways of the fallen ones. You know, giants, those hybrids, ate humans too. They had double.
I know they did.
Okay.
I know.
It was bad. And you know, the Greeks built 10 cities over in around the Jordan and part of Israel, like Scythopolis. And these cities were called the Decapolis cities, the 10 cities, and they worshiped their gods from there, where they thought the legend of Hercules came from. And I'm pretty sure that Heracles was one of the hybrid sons of these fallen ones and the human women. It's all there. I mean...
Well, you know, the big question always comes down to this, Dan. Were they aliens, or was it God, or was it the God that we all know and love from the Hebrew? Was he an alien? I mean,
Wait a minute. Was he extraterrestrial? Did he come from off the Earth?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
He's not necessarily coming from another planet or another galaxy. Our universe is so young, We've figured it out now in physics. It's measured in tens of thousands, if not thousands of years, the entire universe, because of a mistake that was made in radiocarbon 14 dating and other radiometric dating. Yeah. At the Big Bang, they found out here recently that the speed of light and all other electromagnetic radiation at the Big Bang, its speed was 10 with 60 zeros behind it faster. And this meant that all decay rates that we thought were constant were wrong. They had to be applied to what's called an exponential curve. When you do this, the flood, we can picture the flood at around 2345 BC, the breakup of Pangaea, you know, the one land mass at around 2245 BC, and it wasn't 100 million years ago, it was about, you know, 4,000 years ago, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
So, well, see, this is fascinating to me. So who discovered that it was wrong, the carbon dating was wrong?
Well, one of them, Barry Satterfield from Australia, a friend of mine, he has papers. You can look up on the internet, Barry Satterfield, S-E-T-T-E-R-F-I-E-L-D, Barry Satterfield. He's moved here to Washington State now, I think, years ago. And his argument was the first one I saw about this years ago. Now then, a couple of physicists, one I think is an Argentinian, he's a South American anyway, has presented a formal paper, like a challenge to Einstein, and where he mentions that it's the variable speed of light theory. And look up variable speed of light, and you'll see that mainstream physics are all kicking up a storm about it. But when you change the decay rate, the half-life suddenly becomes a lot quicker. Something we might think takes 1,000 years now might happen in 15 minutes in the old days when things were a lot faster.
Well, now that's interesting because I just put on an event called Time Travel Con. And in this time travel, I had a scientist presenting about how things that we think are millions of years old may actually be, because of time compression or different scientific measurements of what time really is.
Yes.
Which we don't know. Don't know.
We know what time is.
What is it? Tell me.
Time is a pure ratio. It has no real dimensions. We only assign them relative to the system we're in.
Exactly. I think that's what he was trying to say, is we have really no way to measure it except for our physiological relationship to it as humans.
Yeah, absolutely. It's correct.
So who's to say that the universe didn't get created 20 minutes ago and I'm just living in a different time space from that creation?
Well, who's to say? Yeah. But the point is, it's compressed, and we're trying to bring the secular timing into agreement with the biblical and Sumerian and Babylonian records, because they,
and that makes sense. And that, you know, it's a good thing that you're doing that, because if we can prove that all of this is in a much shorter time frame than science wants us to believe it was, then it's going to give more credence to everything in the Bible and everything that we're talking about as believers in the stories in the Bible.
Well, it's also going to do something else. It's going to scare the heck out of people when they realize, if that's true, then we don't have hundreds of millions of years for the sun to work and the planet and the universe. Things could go bad really quick.
Well, that's true. Yeah, they could go bad a lot faster than we thought they were going to.
That's called the catastrophic view of history.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, so now we've got a few minutes left in the show, probably about 7 or 8 from my, I never know, Stan. I always feel like I get cut off exactly when I don't think I'm going to be get cut off. But I just wanted to talk briefly about, how do you feel we're going to handle any type of cataclysmic event that may come down the pike? And do you really believe that we're going to have a leader in, like, maybe Jesus Christ or some other type of leader from God, if there is angels, you know, hierarchy angels like Michael or whoever? Do you believe that, like the end times, it says in the Revelations, that we're going to have that type of event happening here? Do you believe the Antichrist is here? Do you think all this is going to happen soon, or are we just going to wait it out and they're never going to show up? I'm getting worried.
That's a pretty busy question.
It is. I'm sorry.
All right.
Get it in, though, because it's my last question for you that I have written down.
All right. Yes, I do believe the Antichrist is alive and well on the planet today. Who he is, I've probably got 3 or 4 really good candidates, mostly all in the Middle East. And that he will come to power with the help of the fallen ones. In Daniel, it says the Antichrist will honor, but not worship, he will honor an alien god. And
That's intriguing.
Oh, look at my final edition of Cosmic Conspiracy, the last episode. I put a whole section in there in translating just 8 verses out of Daniel, which tells you positively that it's like the movie V, that they're going to come posing as messengers of light. They're going to be, you know, reptilian, but they'll look like us, and they will consume us, the whole planet. They're going to divide the earth up into 10 regions and appoint a king over them. But it'll be just like the movie V. People will think they're messiahs, helpers, and that kind of stuff. This is coming, but it's not going to be welcome until we have so many catastrophe lines appearing simultaneously, like famine, which is on the horizon right now. Crazy weather hitting the food supply. Earthquakes, volcanoes, California breaking up.
Like my poor dam right above me here. I live in Sonoma County, and up in the next 2 counties over, I've got a dam that's going to burst over Sacramento, you know?
Yeah, well, watch these things, because the historical thing from USGS is that in California particularly, when you have massive flooding like that and mud flows, you know, like Lahars, even from volcanoes, but certainly from just rain, these seep down into the formations underneath you, and within 6 months to a year and a half after that, you'll have a major earthquake. It'll loosen up the...
Oh, right.
Okay.
God, I hadn't even thought about that. You know, it's interesting you said that, because I've been in California a very long time. I've lived through the earthquake spells and then the non-earthquake spells. I've lived through the droughts and the rains, and you're absolutely correct. Whenever we have this big old Pineapple Express coming through here for a year or a winter, it seems that we have, within the next year, it's earthquake season all over again. And
that's right.
We just have tons and tons of earthquakes. So that makes total sense.
Yep.
How come I never thought of that, huh?
Well, I tell you, when you go to sleep at night, you ought to put one of those inner tubes inflated around you.
You're going to love this, Dan. I just moved out of a house that literally was in the Petaluma River off of Highway 37, off of 101 in Marin County. And I was on a house on mud sills that the tide went in and out under my house.
Oh, wow.
And just as I'm moving out of the place, we have a flood so bad here that the Highway 37 is closed indefinitely because it's underwater. And we were moving, our dolly was going through 6.5 inches of water, getting out to the U-Haul van. I mean, that's how underwater we were. So I was thinking, you know, I must have been told to get out of there for some reason. I'm in a much higher place now.
Yep.
So at least I'm out of the water.
We talked to one lady, a friend of ours over in California. I think she's closer to San Diego, but her neighbor is a fireman, and he has a boat, power, a motorboat, stocked up on like mounts in his backyard, and her family and his are all invited to get onto it when the flood comes.
Oh my God!
And float out to sea.
That's exactly what we had. We had a little boat, a dinghy, out in the front that the neighbors would, you know, if anything happened, we were all going to jump on that boat and get out together. I actually had been in a flood there in 97, 96 sometime, and the Coast Guard actually drove their boat up to my back porch. That's how surrounded by water we were. So,
well, I guess you guys like to live dangerously. That's all I can figure.
I guess. I finally moved. It was 20. I was in that house 24 years, and I got the calling to get the heck out. So, you know,
I don't mean to panic people, but I do think the big one moment is getting a lot closer.
Yeah, I do too. And it's very interesting. And I just, you know, in closing, because we got a couple minutes left in the show, I just want to, what is the most important thing to you that you want people to know about that's going on right now that they can control?
We're all going to die sometime.
Yeah.
Sometime, hopefully long time from now. But in the event that we're going to be killed in some catastrophic civil war or meteor impact or earthquake or whatever, the most important thing is to be sure that you live on beyond this, that you are, as the Bible says, saved. You put your faith in Jesus and hope for the best after that. If you don't do that, you don't have any protection for when you die. And having nearly died once, gone out of my body, I know it's real out there, and our bodies are, our minds and our bodies are much better than they are here. I mean, my mind, I could understand how the universe worked at a blink out there.
Exactly.
So get good with God. You know, be safe.
Yeah, exactly. And I've also almost died myself several times, and I've been to that place of love and light. It is absolutely beautiful, folks. You have nothing to fear, because I wanted to go back very quickly.
So did I.
So there you go, folks. That's it. Stan Deo, best guy ever. Get to his website, standeo.com. That's StanDeo.com. Check it out. Get the book, Dare to Prepare. See you next week on the Fenton Perspective, everyone. Good night.